Hey, it's Anna Sale, and I want to thank you for listening to Death, Sex, and Money, where I explore the big questions and hard choices that are often left out of polite conversation. You can hear new episodes ad-free every week on Amazon Music, where you can find Death, Sex, and Money and all of your Slate favorites without the ads.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com, from the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case, and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
Hey, it's Anna. Just a quick note before we get to our new episode. Earlier this year, we did a series of live national call-in shows centered around our mental health. The series was called Hold On, and it came about largely because of how often we hear from mental health providers in our community of listeners, counselors, social workers, therapists, and more. They've told us through the years that our podcast has been a useful addition to the work they do. We take this as an enormous compliment, and we wanted to make it even easier for mental health professionals to share our show with clients and patients. That's why we created a new episode resource guide called The Things We Need to Talk About More. It's organized around the recurring themes in our interviews: death, sex and relationships, money, family relationships, addiction, mental health, and moving through life stages. You can find this new episode guide on our website at deathsexmoney.org/guide, and you can also download the guide as a PDF to make it easier to share. Let us know what you think. We'd love to hear from you at deathsexmoney@wnyc.org. And now, my conversation with one of my favorite people to talk about mental health with, comedian Maria Bamford.
They'd be like, well, we're just here to have a good time. I am not a good time. I am an assignment from a therapist. I'm a comedian. Some other comedians come to see and go, huh? And I can sell out a room in Portland on a Tuesday.
This is Death, Sex, and Money, the show from WNYC about the things we think about a lot and need to talk about more. I'm Anna Sale. Maria Bamford is a comedian and actress. You may know her from her many stand-up specials or her Netflix show, Lady Dynamite. I first interviewed Maria on the show back in 2020, and she has an excellent new book out called Sure, I'll Join Your Cult, a memoir of mental illness and the quest to belong anywhere. The book is honest, very funny, and genuinely helpful. And I got to talk to Maria all about it in front of a live audience at City Arts and Lectures in San Francisco earlier this fall. Something you say in this book is how full disclosure you have found is a cash cow.
Yes, yes.
And then you...
And a compulsion.
Compulsion. Yeah. And you ask, is this radical honesty or narcissistic showboating?
What do you think?
I think, I would love to say that it's a real happy medium. I think it's very, I've always liked attention. The comedian I just saw, John Mulaney. And one of his last premises he says in his most recent special, and now if I can just get enough attention, I'll be fine. I was like, that's it. Yeah, so I think there's something there. But is it? It's okay. It's okay.
Yeah, well, I'm... I think it is both and, because it is, because the gift of being able to hear what you're disclosing is for somebody who's secretly holding some shame, they have somebody to look at and think it's not just me.
Yeah, like I love autobiographies, biographies, memoirs, where it's like you get to hear all the horrifying things that people have done. I mean, it's just, like I was trying to write this, I kept reading biographies of alcoholic depressive poets going, they're a monster, like just monstrous.
I wonder if how you can talk about at this point in your life, you must have different coping mechanisms, but as somebody who's inclined to share, can you just talk about like over the course of your life, what you've learned about how it feels when you disclose something and then you are not met with understanding?
Yeah, that feels terrible. It always, right? Yeah.
And then what?
Then will you just keep talking and talking until you find somebody who lights up when you say, I'm having a psychotic break, I think, you know, or whatever it is, you know, and somebody doesn't look away. But that's heartbreaking when you get up the courage to tell somebody about something and then they either say, I don't know what you're talking about, or go away, or any number of things. Yeah, and also being open about like being psych, because I didn't realize, somehow I thought a psych ward would be pleasant.
Wow.
Well, I mean, that was just such a big surprise that it was, you know, and I paid money to be in one. One was off insurance. Terrible as well. Like, just like, wow. They had, I went to emergency psychiatric once, and they had, this was, they had a CNN story of basically just a snuff film being played over and over again in the emergency psychiatric. I was just like, can we change this to the Cartoon Network or something? Like, what the?
I maybe this speaks to my naivete, but you tell this story of being very intentional, of going to get inpatient help. You found the place. You looked at the schedule that was posted on the website. You packed.
Oh my God.
What did you learn about that schedule? All the classes.
It was... Okay, so it's called Las Encinas in Pasadena, California. And it, you know, I now call it Lost at Sea because it's so beautiful. And I think they have the same advertising up. This is 10 years later. It, schedule of, you know, yoga. We have addiction support groups. Then dealing with your symptoms, medications, whatever. And then they would have, they had a pool. And once I'd written my check, because I had to write a check for $3,600 because they didn't take credit cards, I was like, you guys know that spending an enormous amount of money all at once on something that may not be rational is a sign of mania. but anyways, I got in and you know, I immediately, because they had a whole schedule up, I was like, oh, I can't seem to find the pool or the yoga. They said, oh, no, That, no, we don't have that. No, that's been gone for years. And I was like, oh, okay. This isn't a hotel. Oh, I know it isn't. I know it's not a hotel, but you guys, your advertising has been suggesting. Yeah, it was just so, that whole where you already feel crazy, and you probably are, and then somebody is, the gaslighting of like, oh, yeah, this is, yeah. Anyways, I'm sure people have that experience. I'm not alone in that. It's very odd.
Speaking of the $3,600, something I so appreciate about all of your work, and in particular, a particular spreadsheet in this book, I love learning about numbers of what people earn and what they spend on things.
Isn't it fascinating?
And I really appreciate it. I skipped ahead to look at it.
Of course.
And so I wonder what for you, when you thought about what you wanted to put in here, like what felt really exciting about sharing the money in, money out of your business and the people you pay to get to do this work?
Part of it is compulsive oversharing. Like I go, am I doing a good job? Is this okay? I did get a couple people say I should raise my rates for my friend Jackie who opens for me. So I did do that. And so it's like, it's farming it out to the community. Like, is this any good? I read some books about open book accounting where different, I think Chobani Yogurt does it, where everybody in the company takes an accounting class. Everybody knows what all the numbers are, so that if you have an argument, you want to get paid more, you know, you have all the information. And I just thought, I know as I wasn't very curious about what people were earning still. Like, so I think my own failures of curiosity of like, oh, can I ask you what you're making? And especially, I think comedy has had a boom in the past 10 years, so a lot of people are making so much more money. So if somebody's selling out a club for the week, and they're selling a lot of booze, like if they're a party act, like they're making 25, 30 grand with merch and stuff. To not give a bump to the open is just like, that's just so sad, or to the housekeeper, that the hotel you're staying at, the Lyft driver who's driving you, like.
What'd you raise the rates to for Jackie?
Okay, so for a while I did profit sharing with Jackie. So when I had the TV show, I gave her 30% of whatever I took it, or, you know, whatever the net was. Net, if you don't know, is the amount of money you will actually get. Gross is the disgusting amount that is never yours. You're not gonna get that ever. I was paying her $1,200 plus air and hotel for every show, but now I've raised it to $2,000 plus air and hotel. I can tell you what I'm earning tonight. I'm earning $2,500. What are you getting paid, Anna?
I'm getting paid less, but I am getting paid. Which is appropriate that you're the draw.
But you're the mother of two. What are you getting paid? Come on.
I actually am not quite sure, but I think it's around $1,000 or $1,200.
Okay, I'll give you a bump, girl.
You mentioned Lady Dynamite there, and one of the most fascinating parts in this book, I thought, was what happens when you become a famous comedian who is famous for accessing mental health care and having mental illness, and then you get a show
about it,
about being someone with mental illness, and you are just recently out of some pretty intensive interventions and figuring out how to work and have a job while you're on new treatment for mental illness. And you describe Netflix being very excited about this show.
Sure.
We're going to help you take care of yourself. We're going to make sure you don't have to work beyond a certain number of hours. And then what happened?
Well, I think it's, It's like every job. Every job you get, relationships in general. Everybody starts out on their best foot of just like, we totally get it. I mean, we just want this to be, we're a family, okay? We see you. You know, like, everybody's trying the best they can, and then the machine starts, and then they're like, oh shit, you can't work weekends? That's kind of fucking us up. Like, yeah, so I don't think anybody was evil or anything. It was just sort of like the first day work, they said, Screen Actors Guild has a 12-hour turnaround minimum, but if they pay penalties, then they can do whatever they want. They can go, it's a 5-hour turnaround, but you'll get an extra 10 grand, I guess.
Meaning you go home and you have 4 hours to sleep, another hour to get.
Yeah. Or just work straight through. Sometimes that can happen on movies and stuff like that. I told them just every time, hey, I know that would be great if I could keep going and not, because every day they would ask me, could you take the penalties and come back sooner? Because we're already behind schedule. And I had to say, oh, yeah, but the thing is, it's real. I will go ballistic. So I don't know if you want... how you want the show to work out, but also like the second season, they got me a tent on stage, which was so nice. I could zip myself in because the medication I'm on, Depakote, Seroquel, and Prozac are all sleepy time medications. So I sleep about 12 hours a night. Like they would, drop me off at home, I'd just fall asleep, and then I'd wake up back up again. But I was exhausted through the day. Like, I was grateful on some level that the show wasn't renewed because it was a little bit beyond my capabilities.
Who, how did you get the tent? Because I'm curious about... I do think it's advocating for yourself in a workplace when you do feel, especially like when you have some power on the set and you're not wanting to create trouble for other people. Like, was that something that you had to kind of be on the front lines and have those conversations yourself? Or did you have...
Yes, it was only, and I think everybody relates with that. Like, you can have somebody who's an advocate, but like I asked my manager, Bruce, and he was just like,
well, I don't know, Maria. I don't know. I mean...
Like, it comes down to you. Like, I had this other thing recently, this is about getting paid, where someone asked me to do a job, and it was somebody who's very famous, of power or whatever, and they didn't mention anything about money. So we kept working together, and I kept having to negotiate salary. And I finally, asked my agent and manager, I was like, hey, you guys, could you talk to this guy? Because I don't want to keep, going, well, it's going to be another $800. And my agent manager were like, let's just say it was Grimace from McDonald's. Well,
Maria, it's Grimace. I mean, he's such a great guy. You definitely want to work with Grimace.
And I'm like, yeah, I do, but... Anyways, but I ended up negotiating it for myself.
For yourself.
I called my lawyer, Lev Ginsburg, and I love Lev Ginsburg. I have never met him in real life, but every time I call him, he's going 50 miles an hour on a 10-speed bike through Century City, California, laughing about how much money he's going to get me.
You just mentioned the medications that you're taking.
Yes.
One of those medications is a medication your mother took.
Yes,
Depakote. For 30 years.
Yes.
And she called it her anti-seizure medication.
Yes.
When you realized that that medication is what was helping you and your mental health, how did it make you rethink what you'd experienced being your mother's daughter?
Yeah, like just that my mom would get really freaked out about ethical things as well as cleanliness and stuff like that. And so now I kind of go, oh, like, yeah, just the passion that she had behind those, and they felt like episodes, like freakouts about, my sister, I think, smoked pot at one point. And, it was bananas, my mom's response, at least I think in retrospect. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say. She never felt like she had any mental health problems. But when she went off of it, she went into a manic episode, and then it was like, But she had cool ideas, which is what... She's like, I'm going to go to the Twin Cities and spend $10,000. Right on.
Is that something... Were you able to discuss that with her before she died?
Yes. And, yeah, my mom was... Yeah, she was the best, and she... Yeah, she was really the best. And I think about her all the time. And yeah, I have jokes about it, like how, like, she loved life. Like, she would be here and she'd be like, oh, Anna Sale. Can you believe it? Can you even? I mean, and then look at this microphone. Isn't this fun? It's really darling, and you know it's been crafted somewhere professional. You know, this is a pretty penny, you know. It almost makes me want to take it home, but I won't. I won't take it home, Nana. I will not.
Do you find you've been doing her voice for a long time? Yeah. Does it feel different doing her voice now that she's gone?
Yes, yeah. I mean, I feel kind of weird about it. Like, I feel like, oh, you know, is that sad? But it's only comforting to me. Like, I like to hear it every once in a while. I try to do it to my sister.
Like when you're in the kitchen making a sandwich.
Yeah, uh-huh. Or I'll do it to my husband and be like, don't. Just because, you know, I don't know. But, she was, I'm sure it's not sexually exciting.
I do wonder, you've talked about with your father was still living when you finished writing this book.
Yes.
And so, is there anything you want to say about losing him?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's interesting because my mom was all prepared. She was kind of ready to die. She'd also been a hospice worker, so she kind of knew what was going on. She was scared, but she was, she had some peace about it. My dad, he got very depressed after my mom died, and he did everything, like everything. He went to a grief group. He, went through a therapist. He got on medication. My dad had always had problems with depression, but he got a girlfriend, and his girlfriend was tons of fun. Her name was Mary, and she brought candy with her everywhere. And she taught him to enjoy board games, which we had never enjoyed as a family before. And Mary got very competitive and would say things like, are you going to go in the crybaby room? So she was so funny and fun. And my dad, he just kind of stopped. He didn't want to eat. And he got this very sort of Karen Carpenter sort of anorexia thing where he stopped. He just kept saying, oh, I don't want to get fat. And I'm like, oh, no, what the fuck are you talking about? And we tried to get him to eat. Everybody tried to get him to eat. And he was around, he was like 5'11", I think like 100 and maybe 20 pounds, very thin. And he was out with some friends, but he still liked to party, hang out. And he got COVID and he was gone within like 72 hours. And it was just so, it was so sad. I mean, I think I got to be there, which was, I'm really grateful for that. But it was, yeah, super sad, because I don't think he should have died that young. He was 82, I think, 82. Mm. So it just kind of sucked.
I'm sorry. I'm wondering if somehow kind of this massive change in your parents no longer living, also in your family there was money that you inherited.
Yes.
How has that changed how you want to spend your time, and has it changed your ambition at all?
Yeah. I think, I mean, obviously I have ambition. I'm lit and have a microphone in my hand. So, yikes. I guess that kind of I do know what it's like to feel like, oh, a dream comes true. And then there's just the next thing, you know? So there's always just the next thing. And often in our society, when you accomplish something, people go,
when's your second book coming out? What are you working on now? What's going on with you? What's your next project?
Oh, I'm done. I finished early.
Coming up, more with Maria Bamford, including why she no longer works with Target. Let me tell you a good story. It was late on a Sunday afternoon, and my family and I had been away and rolled into the driveway, and everyone was worn out from traveling and getting hangry. But waiting for us was a solution. A Hungry Root box filled with healthy, grabbable snacks and a few different dinner meals to choose from. We tore into this thing like a pack of wild animals and ate all the snacks. But they were healthy, whole ingredients, fresh produce. And then we were set for dinner a few hours later, which only took about 15 minutes to prep and cook and get on the table. I was so grateful to my past self for doing my current self this solid by ordering this box. And it was easy. I took a short quiz to tell Hungry Root what kinds of meat my family eats, the sorts of flavors we like, any dietary restrictions we have, or just things we're trying to avoid, and when I wanted the box to be delivered. Right now, Hungry Root is offering Death, Sex, and Money listeners 40% off your first delivery and free veggies for life. Just go to hungryroot.com/DSM to get 40% off your first delivery and get your free veggies. That's hungryroot.com/DSM. And don't forget to use our link so they know we sent you. This is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC. I'm Anna Sale.
We're going to go to audience questions in just a moment, so get ready with your questions. Maria, I wonder if you could tell us the story of when you were in outpatient treatment.
Okay.
And you went home in a van.
Yes.
And you had some friends who knew when you were going home. Can you tell us about that?
Well, it's one of my favorite memories of all time. I was at the Glendale Adventist Hospital psych facility during the day. They had an outpatient program from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. And because you're on so many meds, they'd pick you up at your house. And because it was Adventist, these were giant purple vans. And I don't know what that means biblically, but I do know that they're vegetarians. And so every day when I drive, get a ride home, I text my friends and say, my friends have a small business on York Boulevard. It's an eyeglass shop called Society of the Spectacle. And I'd text them and I'd say, purple van in 20 seconds. And then they would come out on their front door and wave at me. and everybody else in the van. So I felt they were just, they're still good friends, and they, I was so grateful I had somebody come visit me in the hospital every single day, which, I mean, I wasn't fun to be around, so that was very kind.
Well, and also you were texting them, so you were continuing to gather your people, even when the van was going by.
Yes, and it is weird who comes out of the closet or whatever when you tell people you've been in a psych facility. Like, I had so many people go like,
"I'm on lithium. I saw dragons." Anyways.
I mean, people who I never, happy-go-lucky people who I thought had it all together or whatever. I was like, oh, that's awesome. It was nice. That's the other thing about sharing everything, is that people come in and they say the worst moments in their lives, you know.
I sat on my rabbit. It was just a mistake. I'm not a mistake, but that was a mistake.
We're going to go to the audience now. So raise your hand if you have a question for Maria. Let's see,
This first question is all the way on your left.
Okay.
Hi, Maria. Thank you for being here. My question is, I'm curious to know, do you feel most comfortable or happiest when you're among other folks with mental illness? Or are you most comfortable and happy with folks who don't struggle with it? What type of folks do you most enjoy the company of?
Thank you. Don't know. I wouldn't want to call my friends out as... but I have to say, I love any kind of support groups, and stand-up comedy really is just like an ongoing support group where people are trying to tighten up the narratives I think neurodivergency is very, I really love that. You know, I think I feel more comfortable with that. I'm not, or one of the characters that I do is somebody
who I think really has it all together and just really knows, you know, I don't really understand when somebody has a lack of confidence. I don't know, that's just me, because I'm a strong woman, okay? And I know what I want, and...
Like, I just, that is not... I prefer people who are willing to go, "Yeah, I don't know what I'm doing." Because I would think that's majority.
Yeah.
But maybe I could be totally wrong about that.
This question's all the way at the back in the center.
Hi. So I am a psychologist, and I've worked in a lot of settings where, I mean, like, I've seen a lot of shit metaphorically and literally. And, one of the things that I have noticed is a lot of staff apathy rather than empathy. And I'm wondering, from your experience sort of like on the other end of things, what is something that you wish staff at psych facilities, outpatient, you know, mental health care providers in general, what you wish they understood more?
Well, I get it. Like, people who are ill, no matter what they're ill with, whether it's mental or physical, are fucking exhausting. Like, oh, you need another IV? You know, like, it's exhausting. And so I think that's fair enough. And especially mental health facilities, I think they're understaffed. There's also, you can get, I know I worked graveyards at a group home for the mentally retarded and mentally ill. And this, I, got beat up like a couple times. So shit can go down. So it's like you get into something feeling like it's going to be meaningful, and then all of a sudden you're dealing with a very frustrating personality or, people with multiple things going on, addictions, et cetera. So I guess I would just say, I don't know if this is something, but to really take care of themselves. Like, there's just no way you can be helpful to people who are in dire straits unless you're having a good time at night or, like, having a full social life. And, there's just no way.
Could I ask you to tell this? You paint a very vivid picture of when you were in inpatient treatment and you wanted a snack.
Yes.
And you went to the nurse's station. Could you describe what that was like?
Well, it's got the bulletproof glass or whatever that thick glass is. And then there's a little line of us who would get, around 7 or maybe it was after dinner or before dinner, I can't remember. But everyone would line up, and when we line up for like one of those units of graham crackers where there's two and it's in a little package. And the nurses, like, they're busy. They're like, they've got to be doing paperwork, I'm sure. Unbelievable amounts of paperwork that you've got to do from one interaction with a person. So they're just kind of talking amongst themselves. And they're like, clink, clink, clink. Clink, clink, clink. Graham cracker. Just a graham cracker. For baby. Baby wants a graham cracker. I mean, it's... I guess for mental health care, the great thing would be if it was more cheerful of, in terms of, like, you go to a birthing center and it's like everything's pink and people are like, yay! And it might just be hilarious if there was more, upbeat decor. And candy. That sucked. Like, that there wasn't, my friends brought me in chocolate bars every day and caffeine. And that was a sad thing. So it's hard to say, though, because you're so out of it and feel so terrible. So I'm not sure what would necessarily help. But just even caring enough, like I had a couple of people who are very, like a nurse sat down with me and she said, why are you crying? Why are you crying? Why are you crying? And then I think she recognized me from the Target commercials. Because later on I was running around the courtyard in the rain and I was in my bare feet,
as you do.
And she said, you're the Target lady. And I was like, yes, I am. Yes, I am. Anyways, I don't know if that helps, but just that you're doing a wonderful job to even think of that is what I'm saying, to think of, because it's a very difficult job, I would think.
I want to end on Target.
Okay, yes.
There's another story in this book about the experience you had of being the Target spokesperson and then starting to feel very ethically challenged.
Yes.
By whether this was the right thing for you to be doing. And you wrote a letter to the ethicist.
To the New York Times.
At the New York Times. To ask if it was something you ought
to
be doing.
Such a loon. Oh, my Lord. Yeah.
So I'm wondering if Target, which is from your part of America where you grew up,
yes.
It's a very comforting
Positive.
Place sometimes.
Positive.
Is it somewhere that you still go?
Oh my gosh, I certainly go shop there. It's delightful. It's all the progressive messaging that you're looking for, but all the prices of Walmart, because it's still a shit show. Like, they're union busters. They manufacture everything overseas. Like, it's just, it's awful, you know? Like, it's not good. Not good. But it's in bright primary colors, so I enjoy it. But yeah, I got real anxious about that. My solution was, which I was, they fired me, which is, thank God. After that, I don't do any advertising for anything, because I think that's the one thing I enjoyed about doing stand-up, is that I can say whatever the fuck I want about anything, you know? And so to do a commercial and suddenly have to shut up about all the, especially a situation that I'm currently experiencing, was such a bummer. So anyways, Target will not carry this book.
That's Maria Bamford at City Arts and Lectures before a live audience on stage in San Francisco. She has a new comedy album out called Crowd Pleaser, and her new book is called Sure, I'll Join Your Cult, a memoir of mental illness and the quest to belong anywhere. Read it, or the audiobook is also definitely worth a listen. If you or someone you love is struggling with a mental health crisis or the risk of suicide, you can start finding help by calling 988, the National Mental Health Crisis Line in the U.S. Death, Sex, and Money is a listener-supported production of WNYC Studios in New York. This episode was produced by Ellie McKay. The rest of our team is Liliana Maria Percy Ruiz, Zoe Azoulay, Lindsay Foster Thomas, and Andrew Dunn. Thank you to Kate Goldstein Breyer, Holly Mulder-Wolin, and the whole City Arts and Lectures team for sharing this audio with us. The Reverend John DeLure and Steve Lewis wrote our theme music. The show is on Instagram at Death Sex Money, and I'm there at Anna Sale Picks. That's P-I-C-S. And subscribe to our weekly newsletter. If you haven't already, you can sign up at deathsexmoney.org/newsletter. Thank you to Sarah Rose in St. Louis, Missouri, for being a member of Death, Sex, and Money and supporting us with a monthly donation. We could not do this without you, Sarah, and all of our sustaining members. Thank you. And when it comes to finding comfort during a mental health crisis, Maria says that no one compares to her first dog, Blossom.
Especially with intrusive thoughts, like, you know, I could have the most creepy, awful thoughts, and she didn't care. She'd just kind of lean into me as if I wasn't a danger to society. Because, yeah, dogs just, they just sit on whatever you're worried about. And because they like how it feels on their butt.
I'm Anna Sale, and this is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC.
Do you ever feel like there's nothing new in the news? You know there are urgent things happening in the world around you, but all you hear is noise. That's why we made What Next? Our goal is to tell you the stories you haven't heard before, or maybe a different side to the story you thought you already knew all about. I'm Mary Harris, the host of What Next, and I love my job because it helps me cut through the noise of the news. And then I get to bring it to you. Together, we can figure out what next.
I want to thank you for listening and for all your support as we at Death, Sex, and Money have made our move to Slate. Your stories, voice memos, and emails have meant so much to the team. As part of this transition, there's a new way to support our show financially at Slate, our new home, and you'll get something special in return. Subscribe to Slate Plus, and you'll not only support our work on Death, Sex, and Money, you'll get access to new benefits, including listening to us and all of the other great shows Slate makes, like Slow Burn and Decoder Ring, without any ads or sponsor breaks. To subscribe, just click Try Free at the top of the Death, Sex, and Money show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/DSM+ to get access wherever you listen. Thanks.